Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Exploring our oneness with Spirit and each other. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today, I welcome back to the show two professors, Dr. Andy Fort, Professor Emeritus in the Religion Department at Texas Christian University, and Dr. Mark Dennis, Professor of East Asian Studies at the same university, and they're both meditators and highly involved on the groovy spiritual path. That was a little joke from prior to the start of the show here. But welcome, Mark and Andy.
Thanks, Paul.
Our topic today is contemplative studies and how to marry contemplation with enlightened action, because they really nest together if they're going to be at all useful in our lives. You know, it's great to contemplate, but then you have to put feet to your prayers, so to speak. And it's a topic that's garnered a lot of attention in recent years. The fascination with Eastern meditation techniques has inspired people in the West to renew their own spiritual traditions. We're thinking of Father Thomas Keating reimagining the Catholic tradition with his centering prayer movement, and currently a very popular teacher is Father Richard Rohr of Albuquerque. He founded the Center for Action and Contemplation. So there it is. Always found it interesting that he would put action before contemplation. Interesting. Center for Action and Contemplation. I'll ask Andy and Mark what if there's any significance to that in a minute. But right now, let's kick it off. What is contemplation? What does that mean to you?
Gee, I wrote a little note about it. What if he asks this? The first thing to say is there's no unanimous agreement, but there's, I think, a kind of, three ways to expand. One is to, first one is to just be present, to observe what's before you, and that can be done in any number of fashions. And then a second way is to include walking, dancing, not sitting with your eyes closed. So all sorts of things more out in the world, and I imagine you want to hear about that. And a third way is to be more formal about a tradition within a religion in which you have to do certain kinds of rituals or practices, including ethics. So it can be just sitting and being present all the way to a lifelong religious quest.
Yeah, I like that. Did Andy leave anything out, Mark?
No, he's comprehensive.
Pretty comprehensive.
One of the things that I'm sure we'll come back to later is the classes that Andy and I have taught as part of our contemplative studies group on campus. But in his, in his first category that he mentioned, just being aware, I think one of the things that has really kind of attracted us and students is that their attention is so dispersed by social media and other kinds of things that a lot of what we do, I think, is just trying to teach students how to remain focused and aware and not get distracted by all of the kind of information and stimuli that they're bombarded with constantly now.
Well, and the fear is, though, isn't it, that it's kind of boring, you know, that endless stimulation, say Facebook and other means, social media, you know, keep us entertained. And the idea of stopping that and doing nothing is sort of deadly. But there's something about that, isn't there? You have to go through that barrier of apparent boredom to enter into a new awareness, if you like, right? So that you have to be comfortable with the idea of nothing, of doing nothing.
I think that's true, Paul. I think it is for many millennials. It is like an addiction where it's going cold turkey is something that's really. It causes a lot of anxiety and fear among students. But Andy and I both have taught classes where students do extended meditation, mindfulness practices, and they seem to really recognize what the benefits are and get some critical distance on, how powerful social media and these other types of stimuli are in attracting their attention.
Right. In fact, you can hardly imagine what it was like before them. When I was a kid, I didn't even have a phone in the house. I think I was 18 before we had a phone. So if you wanted to phone somebody, you had to go down the street, to a phone booth. So it's come a long way where you're on the phone constantly. But that seemed normal at the time. The pace of life was very different.
I recently read a book, which I found really interesting, and again, I don't want to make this too merely student-oriented, but a book called Mindfulness for the Next Generation, which is written by a couple MDs at universities who really have some insights into how millennials work these days. And it might be said to be boredom, but I think deeper... deeper than that, is this anxiety and fear about, on the one hand, being overwhelmed with all the distractions, but what am I going to do with myself if there isn't that constant stimulation? And they don't have a practice for how to handle not being stimulated. In that way. So on the one hand, and Mark and I are both very familiar with this, and it's really true, the degree of being overwhelmed, feeling pressure, and yet not knowing how to manage and be present to that as a contemplative technique.
Right. And there's a quality of depth to this, isn't there, in the sense that a lot of what we are distracted by or bombarded with is sort of superficial. It's on a certain part of our brain or whatever. When we get into a contemplative practice, we're invited to go kind of a little deeper inside of ourselves and maybe into the subconscious realms as well, open to intuition, things like that. And I shared in the show last week, that when I was in Acadia National Park recently, so many of the tourists there who were hiking, at least they got up and they were hiking. They weren't just sitting in the hotel on the beach or whatever, but they were talking incessantly, and it was very distracting, especially if you were sitting there trying to contemplate the feeling of nature all around you. And it's as if they were still in their mode of, being distracted by all the events of stuff, and they couldn't shift it, or they hadn't yet shifted into that more quiet, listening, attentive place. And I felt a great deal of compassion and sadness, actually, for them, because it was like, you might see something if you just shut up for a second. I think of myself, how maybe I do the same thing. So it's not about judging others. It's about how And what way am I distracted also and not paying attention to what may be available, right? You don't see it until you're willing to be quiet and go a little deeper with yourself.
Well, one of the things I've thought about is the phrase comfort zone, which is used a lot here for people who are in their kind of socioeconomic or racial community, that they're comfortable there. But I think what we're talking about here is there's a comfort zone in a way in that distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And to go underneath that, if you aren't practiced or you aren't in any sort of community which supports it, it's regarded as weird or you don't know how to handle it. And so a lot of what you're describing is, I think, people default mode being in that kind of comfort zone.
And right. Paul, I would add that there have been a number of books and articles talking about how younger people, millennials, have this desire to kind of have this, spirituality go inward, expand their consciousness, think about themselves and their relationship to others. But as we said, they don't have the tools. And, the way that this society is now, they've always got to be doing something to kind of burnish their resume so they can get into a good school. And when they're in school, to do all these other activities so they can get in a good grad school or whatever. And they just don't have the tools and techniques to stop and do these things. And I think once they do, Andy and I have had this experience over and over again, that they see the benefit, but then once the reward, whether it's, an assignment or a grade or whatever it is gone, then they don't continue, which is frustrating, but understandable given the system that they've grown up in and that they're trying to be successful in.
Right, and I think, they're attracted, many of that generation are attracted to more and more extreme sports, the jumping off cliffs and things like that, zip lines and whatnot, pushing the envelope in order to get away from the distractions in a way into some kind of sublimity maybe, but doing it in a very extreme way. Jumping out of aircraft or whatever it might be that's part of this extreme sport that I, more and more kids that I know are doing it, than I ever did and knew about when I was their age. So I think that's part of it. You have to find a way in, right, for folks, help them where they are, if you like. And I remember Rajneesh, who later became known as Osho, had all these dynamic meditations that he talked about, where he'd have all these young people jumping up and dancing, and then at the end there'd be a quiet meditation. And I know a lot of people who came into spirituality that way, because he said, have as much love making as you want, and then come to God, and that appealed to a certain hippie cast of folks back in the day. And I think it's the same with cosmic masses and things like that that Father Matthew Fox does. It's a way in, isn't it? It's using the distraction, using movement in order to lead us into a quieter place.
Well, I'll just say that I co-taught a course with a modern dance professor in which we used movement as an awareness raiser, and certainly raised my awareness. First class I'd ever been in where I wore sweatpants. But this is maybe something you want to go into now or later, but it is important to have some kind of teacher or leader for that to help you understand what can get you into deeper rather than what can get you more distracted.
Right. And, like you say, movement can be very powerful, can't it? It can be a spiritual form, I think.
And one of the exercises that was quite illuminating to me was do a repetitive action over and over and over again and be present. to it. So, you know, I was ready, and we had people come talk about Tai Chi and yoga and stuff, but in this kind of everyday life kind of activity or walk around the trees and be sensitive to the trees kind of as subjects, not just as objects, as, you know, elders. And, okay, how are they looking at you, and what do they have to teach you? And walking around is very interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm very much, you know, in alignment with that. I mean, we were up, our last hike that we took at the end of our sabbatical was on the Bernard Mountain, a mountain on the west side of Arcadia National Park, and there's no one else up there. In fact, we met one couple, I think, but we were alone with the trees, you know. And there's some of the oldest remaining trees on that part of the island, and they're magnificent. But they definitely speak to you. I mean, they're in a language, a meta language, you know, beyond anything you can understand with your rational mind. But it's definitely palpable. And I don't think I'm just a tree-hugging dirt worshiper when I say that. You know, I think it's absolutely true that there's a consciousness there. And, you know, what magnificence, isn't it, to be there for hundreds of years and rooted to the ground, but of having seen so much, having experienced so many weather patterns, you know, having seen so many things pass before you, there's bound to be wisdom in that living thing. So I think it can teach us a lot, that just being in the presence of you know, out of a built environment into a natural setting.
And Paul, I would just add that Andy and I have a colleague, Dave Aftandilian, who comes to our classes, and he does a lot with animals, and so he's come to a class I've taught called Mindfulness and Millennials. And assign students to these exercises where they get out in nature, but then try to engage the animal world through, you know, kind of through the lens as you were saying, as animals as subjects, not as objects. And it was really a profound experience for the students. And, you know, I think it illustrates just what you were saying with nature more broadly, but with this animal exercise. Kind of the irony of, and this again is going to younger people, but, you know, they have all of these connections through, you know, social media, but then there's other kinds of really basic connections, which I think are really healthy, which tend to be lost. And those can include being out in nature or, you know, connections with the animal world and things like that.
Right. Absolutely. I'll just
comment about pets or whatever. Trees or rocks. One of the things in doing this sort of subject-object reversal is to recognize, even when we think we're being still, how utterly agitated we must look to things that rest there in a way that is much more stable and unmoving.
And yes.
Possibly agitated.
Well, and that's part of the paradigm of the master under the tree, I guess. The Buddha is the classic example, isn't it, of someone who sits under the tree in stillness and becomes connected to the wisdom of that tree and, you know, does a tree thing in a way, you know, rooted to the earth and moving, supposedly, and yet so therefore can go deep into, his psyche, in order to, you know, come to some understanding. So it's and I think we see it in all mythology, don't we? The great world tree of the Norse mythology and other traditions, right? There's a definite connection between the tree of life, you know, in the Kabbalistic idea as well. So, you know, it's very rich and fruitful, I think, this contemplation.
Agreed, Paul.
No, I'm against it.
Well, you know, I know Mark has been to Japan many times and influenced by, you know, Zen and other traditions, but you can't go to the Shinto shrines in Japan without being impressed with, you know, the huge cypress trees and whatnot that are growing there. And they're obviously very honored. You know, there's usually sashes around them, right? And they have incense burning to them, and it's this part of the temple structure is it's setting in those amazing woodlands, and so that speaks as well, I think.
Yeah, Paul, I agree with that. I lived in Japan for about 6 years. One of those years was in Kyoto as a graduate student, and I lived in an area not too far from a quite well-known Shinto shrine called the Fushimi Inari Shrine, which was to the fox kami. I went there quite a bit and took whenever friends or relatives would come to visit, I would take them there. And it's really they called it a mountain, but it was more like a big hill. But it was quite striking. It was going into a really peaceful and interesting environment. And so I kept going back and back again because it definitely had a different energy.
And yeah. I know a little later we'll probably talk about social action, but in a way we could call this natural action in the extent that if you're out there and being aware rather than chatting or looking at your digital device, it's almost impossible not to feel some sort of connectedness. And if you practice that, it just makes you aware implicitly of all the ways we are not living in harmony with the earth, with the trees. And so one of the things I like about contemplative stuff is it inevitably, unavoidably brings you into a kind of awareness of connectedness. That you don't have to preach, oh, we should be aware of nature and the trees. You just start to get it.
Yes, I think that's a hugely important point because, you know, so much of the of endeavor is sort of added to. You know, I'm adding this to my life. I'm adding social action because I think it's important. Or it's an intellectual construct around this. So I'm going to add my meditation practice. But it's just another addition, you know, and I think what you're talking about is living from something rather than adding to something. So when you're living from it, it naturally arises that connectedness is there, right? And we see this in quote, primitive peoples, you know, are so in tune with nature that they know when the tsunami is coming and they know when a storm is coming, whether, you know, it's miles away or whatever. And we get resonances, I think, in the Old Testament, too, where, you know, certain of the prophets know when there's a storm arising, even though it may be days away. And you know, therefore, a miracle is ascribed to them because they were able to sort of conjure up the weather. But I think what was really important is they were in tune with it to such a degree that it was a normal, natural thing for them. You know, it wasn't a miracle. It was just being attuned.
Yeah, you know, Marco already mentioned our colleague, who maybe you should invite to our show, Dave Aftendilian, or some with the sort of how to keep some of what the Native Americans had with that awareness that you're describing. When he came to our class, he had us go out to the gardens, the botanical gardens in Fort Worth, and find an animal and try and kind of mimic or model that animal to be like it. And that's just got to have an effect on your sense of relatedness to it.
Yeah, and yes. Paul, I would add that Dave Aftendilian did the same exercise with my students, and they were required in the class to write a reflection on weekly reflection, and then I had a final exam, which was really just kind of reflecting on the semester. And many of them wrote about how there were actually two exercises that he did, but really they were really taken by that because it was something that they just completely ignored. And then when they were kind of, you know, required to go out into nature and observe animals, it really shifted their focus in a really valuable way.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, I'm a bird watcher. I like to, and I'm not obsessive about it, but I do like watching birds. And when we were in Arcadia, we went to a ranger who was, you know, showing birds or whatever, you know, bird watching hour on the coast there. And you know, he knew all the local species and whatnot and the varieties that you might find. But it was quite interesting after a while to notice all the patterns of things arriving and leaving, you know, that you may have not noticed if you were just on the beach, just having a, you know, sunbathing or whatever. But we saw about 30 species, I think, during that couple of hours. And it was quite fascinating. In other words, the invisible becomes visible when we're present to it, you know, when we can stop and be attentive. And going into the same idea, I think, with imitating the beauty of animals, the movement of animals, is to begin to identify with something larger than ourselves, right? Something more wonderful in a way, and it frees us, doesn't it? Of course, it's linked in with the shape-shifting idea, I guess, that you can take on the qualities of you know, another species in order to do some work here. You could take on the qualities that you need to exemplify on any particular day, so you can do work you might not be able to do on your own, which is quite interesting.
This piece of conversation makes me think what I may talk more about next week, the spiritual journey. And the thing I've been involved with for a while talks about knowing and all the different knowings that there are. And one of the practices in the knowings is animals and nature. And when you start kind of contemplating all the knowing of a rock, how long it existed, or the bird, I thought of this, because the bird knowing, what would that be like to be in the air? And of course, you're doing some projecting and imagining because you're human, but the amount of knowing and different knowings that there are in the world, to slow down and contemplate that is just remarkable.
Yes, it is, isn't it? I tend to think that, you know, God is very profligate. You know, God gives us so much, you know, that we can tune into whatever we want any given day. There's a huge university or library of information there on all levels that is just thrown out at us, you know, and we can pass by it and live, you know, mundane, superficial lives if we want to, or we can, you know, be amazed by what's available. And I think that's the joy of it, you know, just opening up a little bit can be a revelation.
And Paul, I would add to what Andy was saying, this, I think this phrase "ways of knowing" is really instructive. That mm-hmm. You know, we're taught in particular ways, and there's what, because of that, I mean, this is natural. There's certain things we can't see, and so, you know, there's this kind of metaphorical blindness. But I think a lot of these kinds of practices are meant to, you know, promote other ways of knowing, and therefore create kind of a more integrative engagement with the, you know, other human beings, with the natural world. And one of the words that Andy used before is, I think he said, out of balance or distorted. And I think, you know, if you look at the religious traditions I work with, Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, others, often are talking about how there is this kind of natural balance. And, you know, if you distort it, and there's many ways to distort it, then negative consequences, whether they're, you know, physical illness or, you know, anxiety or depression or other kinds of things, will inevitably follow. And so I think this idea of integration and balance are really central to all of these different elements that constitute, you know, contemplative studies and contemplative practice.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right, and I think it's true in the macrocosm as well, isn't it? That when we have an imbalance, then, you know, Mother Nature is going to redress it in some ways. Often in violent ways, we see these strange weather patterns that we've never seen before, and certainly not in such magnitude and frequency. And you can't help but say, well, there's something amiss here. You know, that there needs to be some kind of redressing of the balance, so that we can. Another thing I wanted to talk about too was, you know, Carl Jung, when he was interviewed just before he passed, and he was asked if he believed in God. He said no, and then he said, "I know God." And you know, I thought that's a wonderful thing. He shifted from belief about God or hope, if you like, to certainty, right? To knowing it to be true. And it's also taking shifting it from perhaps the cerebral level, the head, down into the heart, because the knowing is intuitive, isn't it? Knowing is not just a sort of a construct of our thoughts, but is also deeply connected to our feeling in that intuitive way.
Yeah, this is something that's of great interest to me in what's called contemplative studies, because obviously the kind of person who's drawn to it and gets into contemplative studies is interested in this richer kind of knowing than the, quote, mere academic knowing. But I certainly, and I know most of my colleagues in it, don't want to disown the sort of, and I'll call it the traditional liberal arts critical inquiry, not negative critical, but kind of examining that you don't give up the head stuff when you move into the heart stuff. But it's a real challenge. How do you integrate them and have them enhance one another?
Yes, very good. All right, well, that's a good moment to break. We've got a couple of minutes of break. Listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll come back and try to answer that question. How do we do that work? Because it's very important. And also, how do we put all this stuff into action in our everyday lives? We've sort of mentioned it, but let's talk more about that. So join us in a couple of minutes after these messages. All right.
As Unity Online Radio continues to expand its programming and outreach to the world, we count on the support of listeners like you. Please make your donation today. Go to www.unity.fm and click on Donate Now.
What got you started on your spiritual path? Minister and radio host Paul John Roach says his path began when he heard George Harrison of the Beatles talking about Hindu philosophy and meditation. Paul John writes about it in the current edition of Unity Magazine. And don't miss the interview with Eben Alexander, the neurologist whose near-death experience led him to write Proof of Heaven. It's all in the September-October edition of Unity Magazine. Go to unity.org and click on Publications.
World as it is.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Professor Andy Ford and Professor Mark Dennis. We're talking about contemplation and action and contemplative studies as something that is important in terms of student life and helping young folks become less distracted and more aware and more in that deeper space of knowing that we were talking about in the previous segment. And, you know, there's certainly many paths to contemplation, and there's styles that, you know, and practices based on each individual's emphasis, I guess, whether it be a more devotional path or a more intellectual path or a path of action, whatever. And these have been codified quite nicely in the Hindu tradition. But either way, whether you emphasize devotion or exercise focused on intellect, it's an embrace of all aspects, isn't it? We are holistic beings. So as you mentioned before the break, it's not a question of jettisoning our intellects because we want to get connected with intuition. They can be married together.
Well, I was going to say, I was leaning into the thing about the contemplation in action. What you said in the prior segment about coming from rather than adding on, that right. doesn't always happen, but that's really the ideal. And to me, many of your listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh. You know, he's not known really in one sense as a social activist, but he just gets interconnectedness or inner being so deeply that he just combines them. And I'm kind of in awe that the rare, should I say bird, a rare being who can do that. But that's something not to think about contemplation as social action as two separate things. You do one and then you do the other, but can mm-hmm. merge one way.
And Paul, I would add, you know, I use a lot of Thich Nhat Hanh's work in my classes, and students really love it. And there's, but I would echo what Andy says, because, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh is known as promoting mindfulness. He has a book called The Miracle of Mindfulness. He's got this kind of inversion of the common aphorism, don't just sit there, do something. And he says, don't just do something, sit there. And so there's this part of him that's this focus on, you know, contemplation and meditation. But then, as Andy was suggesting, he's, you know, he's seen as this founding figure of what's called socially engaged Buddhism. And, you know, the Buddhist traditions have been criticized, sometimes rightly so, for, you know, focusing on kind of individual, you know, spiritual advancement without making these kinds of connections. And he's been a crucial figure, and there are many others, the Dalai Lama and many other figures who have taken this and really tried to incorporate it in their teachings, that, you know, doing meditation and focusing on your own consciousness is an important thing to do. But then, you know, this interdependence, or as Andy mentioned, what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing, is crucial. That in Buddhist thought, we are, you know, there is no you know, substantial enduring self. And so, you know, this self and I that we perceive is kind of this fictitious unity, and therefore we are always connected to other things. And so a lot of this practice is trying to see that and promote activities that, you know, would enable us to connect to others and reduce their suffering. There's really a very big literature on socially engaged Buddhism and kind of its basic principles, one of them being, you know, not turning away, which is the idea of, you know, there's great suffering in the world, and it manifests in many different ways, in rich societies and poor societies, and it's incumbent upon us as ethical beings to not turn away from that and do something. And what we do can be, you know, all kinds of different things. As you probably know, Andy has worked for a long time with the local food bank, but there's many other kinds of activities that kind of represent this underlying ethos of not turning away.
Right, and I think the key word, you know, we mentioned it earlier, is balance, isn't it? It's, I think, because we're all too aware of people who are, quote, do-gooders, you know, who are filled with angst and anger and want social justice for this world, but not bringing a peaceful consciousness to their social action. You know, they're angry and ready to see it as a them and us proposition often, you know, and that's rarely successful. I think ultimately that becomes self-defeating. So the marrying of contemplation and action is for the purpose of bringing a higher consciousness to bear, right? That we can have joy doing this. I think you know, Jesus to me is a great example of this, you know, that, you know, I came that you might have life and have it abundantly, you know, says Jesus, you know, it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Let's have fun here. You know, I'm going to turn some water into wine. I'm going to sing and dance. You know, I'm going to be strict with you sometimes, you know, if you're lost in your heads, but I want us to have a joyful life. And I think we're called to do that, right? Ultimately, it's about the joy of doing these things.
Yeah, well, I certainly, as Mark well knows, am one of these people who's really struggled with letting go of the anger. I found that very interestingly, and this is one of the reasons I like contemplative studies, I found my academic work and my contemplative work really reinforce and enhance one another. But I found my sense of the deep injustices of the world really decenters me. And somewhat humorously, but somewhat seriously, Mark and I do various things here at TCU. And one of the things we often do is what's called loving kindness or metta meditation, in which you start with yourself, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be at peace. And then you expand it out to a friend, to someone you're neutral about, then to an enemy. And then you expand it out even more. And there's certain figures in Washington that Mark teases me about. I have to wish them well. I think in this embodiment, I'm never going to get over that struggle.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, let me just add that we had, you know, Andy was actually away because his grandson was being born, or had been born. But we had a loving kindness meditation for the DACA students on the TCU campus. It was a really nice program. And Andy, if he had been there, he was going to lead it. And I told him he had to say the name that he couldn't say. And he didn't say, but he was going to be forced to.
I guess I wanted to say yes for your listeners. You know, what you said is exactly right. But do not underplay how difficult that is. There is such deep injustice toward marginalized people in so many ways now. And for me anyway, as a, you know, relatively well-off white male, to just sit in lotus position while that happens is not sufficient. So what Mark said about not turning away, very important.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, you know, at the deeper level, when we understand that there's only one of us here, you know, that we are that interbeing, you know, we're part and parcel of the whole, that, you know, when we deny or castigate somebody, even if we feel that's justified, we're doing the very thing to ourselves, because we are that person in some regard. So there has to be that embracing, even of those people that we despise, and we think of the perpetrators of injustice, you know, that we have to embrace them. And because it's good for our soul, then we can be more effective, because we certainly don't want to be, filled with all these emotions that distract us. Coming back to the distractions again, we want something that can free us to be more effective. So I think it's just... It's practical common sense, really, to do that compassionate meta practice, you know, in our lives.
And Paul, I would add, as you were speaking, I thought of an example that I'm always drawn to. But I do a lot with Tibet, the occupation of Tibet and the colonization of Tibet. And there's a really good film. It's a little old now. It came out, I think, in it's either 2003 or 2005, called Tibet: Cry of the Snow Lion. But one of the things that's really fascinating about the Dalai Lama is that he refuses to condemn, the Chinese military, the Chinese government. And there's a really powerful scene at the beginning of the film where he you see him, that he's not getting trapped in kind of this cycle of anger. Because as Andy was suggesting, and as, you know, is true in Buddhist thought, and Thich Nhat Hanh has examples of this too, that this kind of leads to this this downward spiral, and you get trapped in it, and your actions and your emotions then tend to reflect it. So,
right. And that, of course, having said that, that doesn't mean we can't stand up strongly, you know, and with force and vigor to, you know, for the things that we believe to be true. And, you know, And it's okay to get righteously upset, I think, sometimes, as long as we don't, attach to that. You know, it's an aspect of our feeling at that particular time, which is fine. But I think once you identify with it, then you've lost it. And part of contemplative practice, too, is the way of detachment, isn't it? It's detaching from the things that are subject to time and change so that we can attach ourselves, or rather come home to the things that don't change, right? The things that are the essence of ourselves, you know, whether you want to call it spirit or Buddha nature or whatever it might be, you know, that's the work, to be in the world but not of the world.
Yeah, I'm listening to us, and we're giving like lots of Buddhist examples, so I like if you throw something Christian in, but in Buddhism, you probably know upaya, or skillful means, you know, to be skillful, both with yourself, but also with others, because I think about this as I'm now the president-elect of the board of the food bank, so I have a certain kind of responsibility to act and be in a certain way, whereas if I was sort of on the front lines of dealing with some issue, that would be a different kind of, a different sort of action might be appropriate mindfully, you know, doing it, always doing it mindfully, but we're all positioned in different places. And so to be skillful with how we use our power or our activism is very important.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, I've been impressed over the years by African-American leaders, and not just preachers, but politicians and community leaders, not to single out African-Americans, but in the sense that their grace under pressure, their ability to eloquently state their viewpoint in an embracing way, given all the, you know, like you said, you're a white male, I'm a white male too, with all the privilege that has come with that, and to see that grace exhibited in the face of incredible hostility often and ignorance is inspiring, you know, because I ask myself, could I do as well under those same circumstances? So there's something very inspiring about responding with grace and yet also with force, you know, with dedicated energy to see right prevail.
Yeah, Paul, I would just, as you were speaking, I was thinking I do a lot with India. And so thinking about, you know, the oppression of untouchables, but other groups in India, and we're studying Gandhi right now. And he's clearly an example of, you know, being in a very difficult position and never responding with violence, but acting, never just simply being passive.
Right.
So this nonviolent civil resistance and disobedience to an oppressive force. And there's clearly many other excellent examples of that we could identify.
So in the last 10 minutes of the show, what can we, you know, let's pivot to some advice we might want to give to listeners about how to maybe begin or deepen a contemplative practice. How do we get from the contemplation into the action? You know, what are some steps you could offer in that regard?
Well, yeah, I'm glad to get to that. One of the things in this book, The Mindfulness for the Next Generation, it's actually oriented towards students, but be valuable for everyone, that one thing you can do is actually take that 10 minutes out of the day, because you say, oh, I'm too busy, but no one's too busy at some point in the day not to take the 10 minutes and just breathe, you know, and really attend to that. And your mind will throw up thoughts. And one of the phrases it uses repeatedly, which I think is really useful, is rather than being in the flow all the time, the flow of a river, to get off and be on the bank of the river and watch the flow. And so that isn't like, oh, well, now I'm in a demonstration and I have to be mindful. But to actually take that time, realistically, 5 or 10 minutes a day, to stop and use that image of, okay, I'm not going to be in the flow, I'm going to be on the bank, I think that's a important part of eventual social action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would add that, I think one step is trying to gain some kind of critical distance on, smartphones, social media, all of these things that, I use my smartphone. I love it. But it really can kind of take over our lives, and it creates connections that I don't think are as deep and as meaningful as the kinds of connections that we were talking about before, whether it's to other human beings, to the natural world. And so, I think it's probably more pervasive with millennials, but, even for us, I think the smartphones and social media and things like that are so, they're so common that it's useful to try to gain some control over it. It's like sugar, it's a little sugar is good. It tastes, it's sweet. But then if you overindulge it really can have deleterious effects.
And another thing, again, not social action directly, but very useful if one isn't the kind of person to sit for 10 minutes, to take a 10-minute walk and either be more aware, as we were talking about, of the natural or the built environment around us, or actually, and I have assigned this in classes, to walk on the earth sort of not knowing where you're going and not knowing what's next, with what you might call infant eyes, not already knowing what's there or where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a radical, different way of looking that'll take you out. And then when you come back, you'll have a little more distance, as Mark was saying.
Well, there's a long tradition of that, isn't there? Going back to France in the 19th century, where folks would walk out of their houses and just wander around. They were called flaneurs. And the modern version of it is people like Will Self, who call it psychogeography, where you just head out and see what you see. And it is a marvelous exercise because, they have no expectations. It's not like you have an end point in mind. You just go and see what happens. And, so often we're focused on, I got to get somewhere, the end result, that we don't really pay attention to what's between, that here and the end result. And so, yeah, this is a fascinating thing. I love to practice it myself. And I did a lot of it when we were on sabbatical, that were just wandering, just seeing where we ended up that particular day, rather than trying to take in all the sights. It's better to see one thing well than 100 things, like a snapshot of things where you're not really paying attention. And I think put the camera down too. I think that could be a distraction. Sometimes we think we've captured the essence of a place just because we've snapped it on our phones, or on our cameras, and we never actually look at the place itself. And that's sad. So just throw maybe not throw the camera away. Gently put it away for a while. It's expensive. You don't want to hurt it, but. But something counterintuitive, right?
More directly to a sort of social, when you're in a context, and believe me, I am not always successful at this, but at that moment, think briefly at least about that there's a human being over there that's not just a position, a political position, but may they be well, may they be happy, may they be at peace, or...
Mm-hmm.
Our interbeing with them. Again, it's a practice that I often fail at, but that it's even there in mind is a good thing.
Well, we on our journeys, we kept meeting people. We ended up having long conversations with them, and it was quite fascinating. We didn't expect that to happen. We didn't know it was going to happen. But I think if you have an optimistic, open-hearted approach to life, you attract other people who want to talk with you, and that could be one of the wonderful serendipitous things about journeys, and I think that can happen not just if you're on sabbatical or on vacation, but anywhere. You can choose to have a meaningful relationship even with the checkout person, you know, if you want to, or you can be, you know, a zombie and just go through it, you know, without any eye contact whatsoever. So it's an invitation, isn't it, to be present to the seemingly ordinary, but they become extraordinary when we allow ourselves to be there in that presence.
I would agree with that, Paul. I lived overseas for 8 or 9 years and spent a lot of time just kind of wandering around, and it's like you say, if you're open to that kind of experience, and it can be at the checkout counter too, that you do make these kinds of connections and you meet people, and if you listen carefully or deeply instead of just, as Andy was saying, see them as, you know, a political position or whatever it is, then I think this reinforces the kind of sense of, you know, our interconnectedness, our interbeing, in Thich Nhat Hanh's words.
Yes. Well, I hope we've thrown out a few good ideas here. The one or two have stuck for you and you can practice in your life this week. Let me tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Andy and Mark. Next week, Andy's going to be back, actually. He's returning with another professor, Professor Darren Middleton, also of Texas Christian University, and we're going to talk about spiritual journeys. And I know both of those folks have been on extensive spiritual journeys of their own. I want to share a little bit about mine too. We also want to look at the metaphor of the journey as a path to awakening, and then that counterintuitive part of it, where you don't need to go on a journey to discover the essence, and yet oftentimes, unless you do, you won't know that you don't need to go on the journey. So you can tie ourselves up in a conundrum there, can't we? Well, have fun with it. So that should be a good discussion. So join us next week. But right now, thanks to Andy and Mark for a wonderful show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Bye now. Have a good week, everyone. Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
Does the idea of being a vegetarian or a vegan intrigue you? Is it something you've pondered? Listen each week as Victoria Moran, author of Main Street Vegan, shows you how to make the shift to a sustainable lifestyle for both you and the planet. Each week you'll learn about the latest on the vegan life. It's not just for celebrities and moguls, but for people just like you who want to look and feel amazing, eat extraordinary food, help animals, and create a physical body perfectly attuned to spiritual growth. Guests will range from Unity ministers to vegan authors, activists, physicians, chefs, and even some of those glittery celebs. There'll be recipes, ideas, tips for going vegan at your own pace, and ways to make a difference for animals and the planet at every meal. Tune in Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Central Time for Main Street Vegan, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
As a society, we're becoming more conscious of our responsibility to the environment. There are precious resources which must be properly managed. Although it is necessary for me to focus on these outer resources, it's equally important to develop my inner spiritual resources. Within every one of us is a wellspring of peace, a power which cannot be overused, yet often remains neglected. Every time I choose to think and act from that peace within, I bless not only my immediate environment, but the entire world as well. Peace is a precious resource that I can serve best by giving it away. Peace can begin with me.
To find a Unity Church near you, please visit our website at www.unity.org.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.